Imagine stepping onto a clinical unit, ready for your shift. You walk into a patient's room and you see their medication list and bam, right there are antipsychotic medications. Suddenly you realize the immense weight of responsibility you carry. This medication, it could be the absolute key to their stability, their ability to function, maybe even engage with the world.
Right.
But if it's not carefully managed, if you miss, like a subtle sign, it could also lead to a serious, even life-threatening complication.
Exactly.
That's the incredible impact and the profound responsibility that you as a nurse embrace when caring for patients on these powerful drugs. Today, we're taking a deep dive into antipsychotic medications for schizophrenia and thought disorders. This isn't just about memorizing drug names for a pharm exam.
Right. Oh, definitely not.
This is about equipping you, our dedicated listener and future nurse, with the essential, actionable knowledge to provide truly excellent, safe, and, well, effective care. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We've got a fantastic stack of materials here designed to get you well informed on everything from how these drugs subtly tweak brain chemistry to the critical red flags you absolutely need to watch out for in your patients and what to do when you spot them.
Indeed. And our mission today is really to distill this complex information, connecting the dots between the foundational pharmacology and the critical real-world nursing practice you'll encounter every single day. Mm. What's particularly fascinating here, as the sources emphasize, is how clearly the objectives for nurses are laid out. You need to assess for adverse reactions with precision. Right. Analyze the therapeutic actions to make sure the drug is actually working. And then most importantly, implement appropriate nursing care strategies that make a tangible difference.
Makes sense.
We'll hit all three of these pillars, ensuring that by the end of this deep dive, you'll have a solid, confidence-inspiring foundation for understanding these powerful medications, making you a more competent and safer nurse as you move forward in your studies and clinical practice.
So where do we begin this deep dive into these fascinating but, yeah, incredibly powerful medications? Our sources immediately break these down into two main generations.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of gives us a historical and clinical roadmap. Can you give us the overarching view of how these are classified?
Absolutely. When we talk about antipsychotics, we primarily categorize them into two major groups, often referred to as generations.
Mm-hmm.
First, we have the typical antipsychotics, also known as first-generation drugs. These are the older medications developed primarily back in the 1950s. A lot of them are phenothiazines, like chlorpromazine being a classic example.
Morazine.
Exactly. Or non-phenothiazines, such as haloperidol. They were truly revolutionary breakthroughs at the time. I mean, offering the first effective pharmacological treatments for severe psychosis.
A huge deal back then.
Oh, absolutely. Then, building on that foundation, we have the atypical antipsychotics or second generation drugs.
The newer ones.
Yep. These are newer, emerging mostly in the 1990s and beyond, and they are generally chemically distinct from their predecessors. Crucially, they were developed aiming to improve on the first generation, and they often come with milder side effect profiles. Particularly a lower incidence of those severe motor disturbances.
Okay, that's key.
This historical progression from first to second generation, it really highlights an ongoing effort in pharmacotherapy to improve both efficacy and, just as importantly, the patient's tolerability and overall quality of life.
Right.
For you as a nursing student, understanding this distinction helps you anticipate not just the therapeutic effects, but also the different types of adverse reactions you might see.
That's a great overview. The older typicals and the newer atypicals, each with their own sort of characteristics and, like you said, different side effect considerations. But beyond just categorization, which is essential, how do these drugs actually work? What's happening, at the cellular level to relieve these really intense and often debilitating symptoms of psychosis? It almost feels like magic sometimes when you see the transformation, but it's really a precise chemical dance in the brain, isn't it?
It truly is. And understanding this core principle, this chemical dance, is absolutely key to grasping their therapeutic effects and, frankly, anticipating their side effects.
Okay.
Antipsychotic medications primarily work by preventing key neurotransmitters from occupying specific receptor sites on neuronal cell membranes. The main players here, the chemical messengers we're most concerned with, are dopamine and serotonin.
Dopamine and serotonin. Got it.
Think of it like a highly specialized lock and key system within the brain. Neurotransmitters are the natural keys that fit into specific locks, the receptors on brain cells, triggering various responses.
Makes sense.
These antipsychotic drugs act as a kind of false key or maybe a very effective blocker. They sit in the lock of the receptor, especially those dopamine D2 receptors for typical antipsychotics.
Right.
And both dopamine and serotonin receptors for the atypicals. By occupying these locks, the natural key, the neurotransmitter itself, well, it just can't fit or activate it. This essentially dampens down excessive signaling.
And by blocking those receptors, particularly for dopamine, what exactly happens then? How does that mechanism translate into the significant relief of symptoms we see in patients, you know, transforming their experience of reality?
Precisely. This receptor blockade leads to fundamental changes in those neuronal receptors and, consequently, in cellular functions downstream. By modulating these critical signaling pathways, the drugs essentially help to rebalance the brain's neurochemistry.
Rebalance, okay.
In conditions like schizophrenia, there's often an overactivity in certain dopamine pathways, which is thought to contribute significantly to the positive symptoms of psychosis, things like hallucinations and delusions.
The things we most often think of.
Exactly. By blocking those dopamine receptors, especially in the mesolimbic pathway, these drugs reduce that excessive signaling. If we connect this to the bigger picture for you as a nurse, this rebalancing ultimately provides the therapeutic effects we're looking for. A significant reduction in the severity and frequency of psychotic symptoms.
Mm.
Patients become less agitated, their hallucinations might diminish or disappear, and their delusions become less intrusive or dominant. It helps restore a more balanced and functional state for the individual,
allowing them to function better day to day.
Right, allowing them to engage with reality more effectively and improving their capacity for daily living. Understanding this mechanism helps you appreciate why the patient is receiving the medication and what changes to look for in your assessments.
The name itself, antipsychotic, immediately makes us think of conditions like schizophrenia, which is, well, the primary indication. But it's not just for that, is it?
No, not at all.
What are the other major reasons a patient might be prescribed these powerful medications? What are the key indications you, as a nurse, would expect to see, maybe in a broader range of clinical settings than just a psychiatric unit?
That's a really important distinction, to think beyond just psych units. While the major clinical indication is unequivocally schizophrenia, their utility extends significantly beyond this one diagnosis. They're actually pretty versatile tools in various medical contexts.
Okay.
We frequently see these medications used for psychotic symptoms associated with a whole range of other serious medical conditions.
Such as?
For example, a patient might be prescribed an antipsychotic if they are experiencing psychosis due to, say, head trauma, a brain tumor, or maybe a stroke.
Ah, okay. So acute neurological events.
Exactly. These events can sometimes trigger temporary but severe psychotic states that require pharmacological management. They can also be absolutely crucial in managing symptoms during severe alcohol withdrawal.
Oh, right. The DTs.
Yes. Where profound agitation, delirium, and terrifying hallucinations, delirium tremens can occur. Similarly, in cases of CNS stimulant overdose, where patients might experience extreme paranoia, agitation, even frank psychosis, antipsychotics can be a lifesaver.
Makes sense.
And interestingly, some first-generation antipsychotics, notably haloperidol, are specifically used for certain severe movement disorders like Tourette's syndrome to help manage severe podictics and vocalizations.
So, thinking practically, a patient in the ICU recovering from a traumatic brain injury might suddenly start experiencing acute psychosis.
Right.
And the medical team could then prescribe an antipsychotic, not necessarily because they have a pre-existing mental health condition, but specifically for symptom management related to that injury.
Precisely.
That's a crucial distinction for nursing students to understand, kind of expands their view beyond just the mental health ward.
Exactly. It really highlights the importance of a holistic assessment and understanding the diverse applications of these drugs across various clinical settings. It's about managing symptoms wherever they arise, not just within a specific diagnostic label.
Yep.
Now, building on that, once a patient starts on these medications, what are we as healthcare professionals, and particularly as nurses, actually aiming to achieve? What does the roadmap for recovery look like, and how do we measure progress effectively?
That's a great question, because it helps frame our nursing interventions directly. What are those goals, especially in the early, often critical, stages of therapy?
The goals are quite clear and typically progress in stages, which is really important for you as a nurse to understand for patient assessment and education. In the immediate period of acute psychosis, particularly during the first week of therapy,
first week.
The immediate goals are primarily to decrease the severity of those distressing symptoms. We're talking about reducing acute agitation, calming overwhelming hallucinations, stabilizing potentially dangerous behaviors.
Just getting things under control.
Exactly. And just as importantly, we aim to normalize basic physiological patterns like sleeping and eating, which are often severely disrupted during a psychotic episode. Think of it as stabilizing the acute crisis, getting the patient out of immediate distress and establishing foundational well-being and safety.
And your role as the nurse?
Your role here is to continuously observe and document these changes, ensuring the medication is having the desired effect, watching for side effects, basically being the eyes and ears.
And after that initial stabilization phase, once the crisis is somewhat managed, what do we focus on then? What's the next step in their journey towards recovery and a more functional life?
Then we move to subsequent goals, which often unfold over the next few weeks or months. Once the acute symptoms are somewhat managed and basic physiological patterns are normalized, the focus shifts to more functional improvements and reintegration.
Okay.
This includes an increased ability for self-care, things like personal hygiene, grooming, dressing appropriately, managing basic daily tasks.
Activities of daily living, ADLs.
Exactly, ADLs. And equally important is increased socialization. This is where you, as a nurse, really start to see the patient engaging more in their environment, maybe participating in therapeutic group activities, initiating conversations, or interacting more meaningfully with staff and family. It's about building their capacity to live more independently.
Seeing that progress must be rewarding.
It really is.
And the long-term vision. What's the ultimate aspiration for these patients, and how do antipsychotics contribute to that sustained quality of life?
The long-term goals extend even further, aiming for sustained quality of life, functional independence, and critically, relapse prevention.
Preventing future episodes.
Absolutely. These include increasing the patient's overall ability to cope with their environment, developing resilience against stressors, and promoting optimal functioning in self-care and activities of daily living on an ongoing basis. Critically, a major long-term goal is preventing acute episodes and hospitalizations, which can be incredibly disruptive and damaging to a patient's life trajectory. This entire framework, from acute stabilization to long-term prevention, helps guide all your nursing interventions, ensuring that care is comprehensive, patient-centered, and continuously moving towards the best possible outcome for the individual. Your patient education, symptom monitoring, and advocacy are vital at every single stage.
All right, let's start digging into some of the specific medications, beginning with the first generation, the typical antipsychotics. Chlorpromazine, or Thorazine, is often mentioned as a key prototype.
Yeah.
A foundational drug, right? Really revolutionized mental health care.
Absolutely.
What's its story and how does it generally work?
Chlorpromazine, indeed, is a classic phenothiazine and was the very first antipsychotic ever synthesized. Its introduction in the 1950s was a monumental shift, often credited with starting the deinstitutionalization movement.
Ah, right.
Because it allowed many patients to manage their symptoms outside of long-term hospitals. Its primary mechanism, as we discussed, involves blocking postsynaptic dopamine D2 receptors in the brain. It's still used today to control a range of severe psychotic behaviors, including acute and chronic schizophrenia, alleviating hallucinations, delusions, bizarre behavior. It can also be used for psychotic symptoms linked to brain impairment from trauma or other medical conditions, and believe it or not, even for intractable hiccups.
Hiccups, wow, okay. Any particular cautions or watch-outs for nurses with chlorpromazine? I imagine older drugs often come with more significant considerations, especially given its history.
Absolutely. Nurses need to use chlorpromazine with significant caution, and that means vigilant monitoring in certain patient populations. The elderly are particularly vulnerable.
Why is that?
Well, due to altered metabolism, increased sensitivity to side effects, and often polypharmacy, they're usually on multiple meds. Similarly, patients with renal and liver impairment require careful monitoring, as their bodies might process the drug differently, leading to higher drug levels and an increased risk of adverse effects.
So, as the nurse, you need to be hyper-aware.
Definitely. In terms of common side effects, you'll definitely see major CNS effects, like prominent sedation, which can impact patient safety, obviously.
Big time.
But a critical group to watch out for are the extrapyramidal effects, EPS. These are a hallmark of typical antipsychotics and can be very distressing for patients. We'll talk more about those later.
Okay.
Additionally, it can cause significant cardiovascular effects, such as a prolonged QTPR interval, T-wave blunting, and ST depression.
So heart issues.
Yes. And for you, the nurse, this means it's not just a check the EKG box task. It's understanding that these cardiac changes can predispose your patient to serious, potentially life-threatening dysrhythmias like torsades de pointe.
Wow. Okay.
So any new palpitations, chest pain, or dizziness need immediate, thorough investigation. It elevates the importance of that baseline EKG from just a procedural step to a critical ongoing safety measure.
Got it.
Hematologic issues, including agranulocytosis and pancytopenia, although less common, are serious risks that demand awareness and immediate reporting.
So for the nursing students listening, what are the direct practical implications for their care plans and patient education when a patient is on chlorpromazine? What do they actually do?
Okay, good question. For nursing considerations, remember, it's quite versatile in administration. It can be given both intramuscularly, IM, and orally.
IM or PO?
Due to those significant cardiovascular effects I mentioned, an EKG may be ordered prior to administration to establish a baseline and monitor for changes during therapy. Very important.
Definitely.
Your primary role involves rigorous, continuous monitoring for all potential side effects, assessing the patient's neurostatus, vital signs, overall well-being. And crucially, for patient education, you must teach the client to avoid alcohol, sedatives, and antacids.
Why antacids?
Alcohol and other CNS depressants will significantly increase the sedative effects, posing a risk for falls and altered consciousness. Antacids, specifically, are known to reduce the drug's absorption, making it less effective, so they should be taken at least 2 hours apart.
Good tip.
You also need to educate about photosensitivity, advising protective clothing and sunscreen. This depth of education is vital for patient safety and adherence.
Moving to another key first-generation drug, haloperidol, or Haldol. This one seems to pop up a lot in different contexts, ERs, Tourette's. It feels almost ubiquitous.
Haloperidol is indeed another prominent first-generation typical antipsychotic. It's a non-phenothiazine, so chemically distinct from chlorpromazine, but has a similar mechanism.
Blocking dopamine D2.
Exactly. It primarily blocks postsynaptic dopamine D2 receptors in the brain. Its uses are quite broad. It effectively treats schizophrenia, but it's also famously used for Tourette syndromes to manage severe iatics, also used for acute and chronic psychoses, and even in managing severe agitation and behavioral disturbances linked to dementia, but with significant caveats we'll discuss.
Right, the dementia issue.
It's often used in emergency settings for rapid tranquilization due to its potent antipsychotic and sedative effects.
What are the big things to be aware of with haloperidol? Are there specific patient populations or conditions where it needs to be avoided or used with extreme care?
Absolutely. Cautions for haloperidol are extensive and critical for you to remember. Patients with narrow-angle glaucoma should generally avoid it, as it can worsen this condition.
Okay.
Due to its sedative properties, caution is needed when patients are doing tasks requiring alertness. Furthermore, patients with severe liver, kidney, or cardiovascular disease, or those with blood dyscrasias, require careful assessment and vigilant monitoring. Big potential for adverse effects on those systems.
Makes sense.
The side effects themselves are broad and can be quite impactful, ranging from profound sedation, headache, seizure exacerbation, to a high incidence of EPS.
There's EPS again?
Yep. Also, dry mouth, blurred vision, photosensitivity, tachycardia, orthostatic hypotension, dysrhythmias, and urinary retention.
Wow, that's a list.
It is. The list is extensive, demanding comprehensive and continuous nursing vigilance. When your patient reports any of these, your critical thinking needs to kick in immediately. Is this a new symptom or is it a drug side effect?
That's a lot to monitor, and it really emphasizes the importance of a thorough head-to-toe assessment. And what about drug interactions? What can nurses tell patients to avoid, or what other medications should they be wary of combining with haloperidol?
Good point. In terms of interactions, nurses need to be aware of several key combinations. There's increased sedation when haloperidol is taken with alcohol, and other CNS depressants, think benzodiazepines, opioids, and histamines. That can be dangerous, leading to respiratory depression or falls.
Definitely risky.
There's also increased toxicity if taken concurrently with anticholinergics, which can precipitate an anticholinergic crisis. We'll talk more about that later, too.
Okay.
Conversely, decreased effects of haloperidol can be seen when given with drugs like xenobarbital, carbamazepine, often used as mood stabilizers or anti-seizure meds, and even caffeine.
Caffeine.
Yeah, it can compromise its therapeutic action, potentially leading to symptom relapse. So a thorough medication reconciliation is absolutely non-negotiable.
Absolutely.
Crucially, haloperidol carries significant black box warnings. These are the strongest warnings the FDA issues.
Okay, pay attention here.
For newborns, there's a risk of withdrawal symptoms if used during the third trimester of pregnancy. So you need careful monitoring of infants born to mothers on this med for tremors, agitation, or feeding difficulties.
Right.
And this is particularly important for nurses in geriatric settings. For the elderly with dementia, it significantly increases the risk of cardiovascular events like heart failure or arrhythmias and infectious diseases, particularly pneumonia.
That's the big one we mentioned.
Yes, this particular warning underscores a critical vulnerability and often means haloperidol should be used as a last resort in this population, if at all.
That black box warning for the elderly with dementia is really striking. I imagine nurses encounter that frequently in long-term care or acute geriatric units.
Yeah.
What's the direct nursing takeaway here? How does that inform their day-to-day practice?
It means vigilant monitoring, careful risk-benefit analysis, and considering alternative treatments for this vulnerable population are absolutely paramount. Nurses need to be keenly aware of this increased risk when administering haloperidol, especially in geriatric settings, and advocate for their patients if they see concerning signs.
Advocacy is key.
Totally. As for general nursing considerations, it can be administered PO or IM, depending on the acuity, IM for rapid tranquilization, PO for maintenance. You must rigorously monitor for all the side effects we mentioned. And specifically, be on the lookout for interactions with certain herbal supplements.
Oh, like what?
Things like kava, Gotu Kola, St. John's wort, and valerian. These can potentiate or interfere with the drug's effects and compound sedation.
Good to know.
This is a perfect example of how the so what of pharmacology directly impacts daily patient care and safety, demanding your full attention and critical thinking skills.
Now let's turn our attention to the newer kids on the block, the atypical antipsychotics, also known as second-generation drugs. These are often highlighted as a significant advancement. What makes them different from the typicals, and why are they often preferred, particularly for newly diagnosed patients?
Right. These are often considered the drug of choice for newly diagnosed schizophrenia, and for some very compelling reasons. They are chemically distinct from the older first-generation drugs, and their mechanism of action is generally broader.
How so?
They target both dopamine, though often with a weaker, more selective D2 blockade and serotonin receptors, as well as others. A significant advantage is that they are generally more effective in relieving some symptoms, particularly the negative symptoms of schizophrenia.
Ah, the negative symptoms, like withdrawal, apathy.
Exactly. Social withdrawal, apathy, anhedonia, that inability to feel pleasure, lack of motivation. These are often the most debilitating symptoms and areas where typicals sometimes fall short.
Right.
Crucially, and this is a major selling point, they usually produce milder adverse effects, especially a lower incidence of the severe ectopyramidal effects, EPS, we discussed earlier, those motor side effects that are so distressing.
Less EPS is definitely a plus.
Oh, huge! This milder side effect profile, in turn, often leads to improved patient compliance with their medication regimen. Think about it. If a patient feels less burdened by side effects, they are far more likely to continue taking their medication as prescribed.
Which is vital.
Absolutely vital for long-term stability and relapse prevention. This raises an important question. Why is compliance so critical in long-term mental health management? Because without it, all the other interventions might just fall apart.
That sounds like a significant win-win situation.
Yeah.
More effective for a broader range of symptoms, milder side effects, leading to better compliance. But in healthcare, there's always a catch, isn't there?
Huh.
Usually.
What's the major drawback that our sources highlight? What prevents them from being universally adopted?
Indeed, there is a catch. The major drawback, as our sources highlight very clearly, is that they are generally dollar dollars.
Ah,
The cost.
yeah. This can be a significant barrier for patients, particularly those without robust insurance coverage. It potentially impacts adherence and access to treatment, even with their clinical advantages. This cost factor sometimes means typicals are still used, especially in resource-limited settings.
Right.
But despite this, their improved efficacy and tolerability often make them the preferred initial choice when financially feasible. Some of the well-known prototypes in this class include clozapine, Clozaril, aripiprazole, Abilify, lurasidone, Latuda, olanzapine, Zyprexa, quetiapine, Seroquel, risperidone, risperidol, and ziprasidone, Geodon.
Quite a few options.
Yep. Each has its own unique profile, but clozapine really stands out for its specific benefits and, well, its risks.
Let's zoom in on clozapine, or Clozaril. That seems particularly important. It's often used in complex, treatment-resistant cases, and it comes with some very serious warnings. What makes it so unique and potent?
Clozapine is indeed a powerhouse and, as you noted, particularly important. It's an atypical antipsychotic with a significantly more complex and broader mechanism of action than many others. It doesn't just block dopamine receptors, particularly D2.
Oh.
It also exerts profound effects by blocking serotonin, 5-HT2A, and even glutamate receptors. Additionally, it has anticholinergic, antihistamine, and alpha-adrenergic blocking activity.
Wow, it does a lot.
It really does. Broader receptor profile often contributes to its robust efficacy, especially in treatment-resistant cases where other antipsychotics have failed. It really works across multiple neurotransmitter systems, giving it a unique therapeutic effect.
What are its main uses then, and what makes it first line for some conditions despite its inherent complexity and risks? Where does it really shine?
It's considered first-line therapy for treatment-resistant schizophrenia. That means when a patient hasn't responded adequately to at least two other antipsychotics. So it's not typically the first drug prescribed.
But for tough cases.
Exactly. It becomes invaluable when others have failed. And notably, it's also used specifically in psychosis to reduce the risk of recurrent suicidal behavior in patients with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder.
That's huge. Life-saving.
Absolutely. This truly fills a critical and life-saving niche for a very vulnerable patient population, demonstrating its unique and profound impact on preventing a devastating outcome. Its efficacy in these specific areas is pretty much unparalleled, which is why we continue to use it despite its risks.
But it also comes with some very serious warnings, doesn't it? Those black box warnings, the strongest the FDA can issue, are certainly present for clozapine, making it a drug that demands extreme caution.
It does, and these warnings are absolutely paramount for nurses to understand and meticulously monitor. Clozapine carries multiple very serious black box warnings.
Okay, like what?
These include risks for elderly patients with dementia, an increased risk of seizure disorder, especially at higher doses, and most critically, severe hematologic issues, specifically agranulocytosis.
Agranulocytosis. Okay, break that down.
It's a severe and potentially life-threatening reduction in white blood cells, specifically neutrophils. This leaves the patient extremely vulnerable to overwhelming infection.
Extremely dangerous.
Very. There are also warnings regarding metabolic issues like hyperglycemia and significant weight gain, cardiovascular risks such as orthostatic hypotension and myocarditis, and a risk of severe respiratory depression. As a nurse, you are the frontline defense against these potentially fatal complications.
Agranulocytosis sounds terrifying, and rightfully so. What does that mean for nursing students in practice? How do they, as nurses, actually manage a patient on clozapine given this severe, potentially fatal risk? What's the day-to-day vigilance required?
This is where vigilance is absolutely non-negotiable. It represents a truly critical nursing responsibility, a level of scrutiny almost unmatched for other medications.
So really intensive monitoring.
Incredibly detailed and stringent. Before initiating therapy, you must ensure the patient has baseline WBC, white blood cell, and neutrophil counts, along with blood glucose levels to monitor for metabolic issues.
Baseline test. Got it.
The drug must always be tapered on and off, never stopped abruptly, to prevent severe withdrawal effects or rebound psychosis. You'll continually assess for therapeutic effects like decreased agitation and psychotic activity, but also monitor temperature, EKG, and blood pressure regularly because of the cardiac risks.
Okay.
Crucially, nurses must monitor closely for flu-like symptoms, a sore throat, fever, general malaise. These could be an early, subtle indicator of agranulocytosis.
So don't dismiss those symptoms.
Absolutely not. These aren't just minor complaints. They demand immediate investigation. Given this severe hematologic risk, the drug distribution itself is tightly controlled through a national registry.
A registry?
Yes. The drug is distributed 1 week at a time, and only if weekly blood tests, WBC and ANC, absolute neutrophil count, are within safe limits.
Weekly blood tests, wow.
If the counts drop, the drug is held or discontinued. This level of intensive, mandatory monitoring for blood counts is unique to clozapine and is absolutely critical. It highlights that knowledge is most valuable when understood and applied vigilantly in every single step of patient care. You become a vital part of a very tightly managed safety protocol.
Beyond specific drug warnings like those we just discussed for clozapine and haloperidol, Are there general patient conditions where antipsychotics are simply contraindicated, meaning they absolutely should not be used, regardless of the specific drug?
Yes, there are several general contraindications that nurses must be aware of, as administering an antipsychotic in these situations could be severely detrimental.
Okay, what are they?
Antipsychotics should generally not be used in patients with pre-existing conditions like significant liver damage or severe coronary artery disease, cerebrovascular disease. The drugs can exacerbate these conditions or add undue stress to compromised systems.
Makes sense.
They are also contraindicated in Parkinsonism due to their dopamine-blocking effects, which would worsen the motor symptoms. Furthermore, patients with bone marrow depression are at increased risk of hematologic issues like agranulocytosis, compounding the risk already associated with some antipsychotics.
Right.
Severe hypotension or uncontrolled hypertension, profound coma, or severely depressed states also typically preclude their use.
So, a lot of serious conditions.
Yeah. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these conditions often interact negatively with the drug's known side effects or significantly impair the body's ability to metabolize and excrete the medication safely. It just poses substantial and unacceptable risks to the patient. Your role is to understand these and advocate for patient safety.
And what about situations where you can use them, but with extreme caution, requiring nurses to be even more vigilant than usual? These are the sort of gray areas that demand a truly sharp assessment.
These situations represent a delicate balance where the potential benefits might outweigh the risks, but only with heightened awareness and continuous monitoring.
Like what kind of conditions?
These include patients with a history of seizure disorders, as some antipsychotics lower the seizure threshold. Also, diabetes mellitus, due to the risk of metabolic side effects and new onset diabetes.
Right. The metabolic issues.
Glaucoma, due to anticholinergic effects, prostatic hypertrophy, which can aggravate urinary retention, peptic ulcer disease, and chronic respiratory disorders, where sedation can be problematic.
Okay.
In these cases, the nurse's role in closely monitoring for the exacerbation of these pre-existing conditions or for specific drug-related side effects becomes even more pronounced.
Give me an example.
Sure. An antipsychotic might be used, but with very frequent blood sugar checks for a diabetic patient, careful respiratory assessments for someone with chronic lung issues, or monitoring for urinary output in a patient with prostatic hypertrophy. It's just about a magnified level of vigilance.
Got it. With so many options, different generations, and a huge list of potential side effects and contraindications, how do prescribers even begin to choose the right medication for an individual patient? It seems like a very complex, tailored decision. Definitely not one size fits all.
Drug selection is indeed highly individualized. It requires a comprehensive assessment of the patient that goes way beyond just the diagnosis.
What factors are key?
Factors include the patient's age and physical condition, as these profoundly influence metabolism, excretion, and susceptibility to side effects. The severity and duration of their illness also play a role in determining the intensity and type of treatment needed.
Makes sense, like acute versus chronic?
Right. An acute crisis might warrant rapid tranquilization with an IM typical, while long-term stability might favor an atypical. A critical factor is balancing the therapeutic gain against the frequency and severity of potential adverse effects.
Hmm.
Prescribers aim for the best outcome with the fewest burdens.
Trying to find that sweet spot.
Exactly. Furthermore, the patient's past response to antipsychotics, what worked or didn't, what side effects they experience, that's invaluable information for guiding future choices.
Learning from experience.
Definitely. The level of supervision available for monitoring and even the physician's experience and comfort with a particular medication all contribute to this complex decision-making process. It's truly a bespoke approach to pharmacotherapy, aiming to optimize the individual's journey toward recovery.
This isn't a short-term fix, is it? We're not talking about a course of antibiotics that you take for, like, 10 days.
Yeah.
What does the deep dive tell us about how long patients typically need to be on these powerful medications? This seems critical for patient education.
This is such a critical point for nurses to emphasize with patients and their families, as it directly impacts adherence and relapse prevention. In schizophrenia, these medications are usually given for years.
Years, wow.
Often due to a high rate of relapse when drug therapy is discontinued. All too often, patients themselves stop their regimen, maybe unwilling or unable to continue due to bothersome side effects.
Or they feel better and think they don't need it.
Exactly. Or a mistaken belief they're cured because symptoms have abated, stigma associated with taking mental health medication, or sometimes just a lack of insight into their illness.
Right.
This raises an important question about patient education and the long-term strategies we use to support adherence over the long haul.
So what are the guidelines for duration?
Specifically, for someone experiencing an initial psychotic episode, drug therapy is indicated for at least 1 year after symptom remission.
1 year minimum for the first time.
Yes. For those with multiple episodes, a much longer duration, at least 5 years, or even lifelong therapy is often recommended due to the high likelihood of recurrence.
5 years or even lifelong.
The evidence unequivocally shows that low-dose continuous maintenance therapy is considered highly effective for the long-term prevention of recurrent psychosis.
So the nurse's role here is huge in education and support.
Absolutely. Your role as a nurse goes way beyond just handing out pills. It's about therapeutic communication. Understanding why a patient might stop. Is it cost, side effects, stigma, or that mistaken belief they're cured?
Getting to the root cause.
Right. It's about proactively teaching them coping strategies for side effects, connecting them with support systems, and advocating for less expensive alternatives if cost is a barrier. You're not just a medication administrator. You're a long-term care coordinator, a patient educator, and a vital advocate for sustained stability.
All right, let's talk about one of the most talked about and often frightening categories of side effects that nurses will definitely encounter, extrapyramidal effects, or EPS. You know, when I think about side effects of these medications, EPS always comes to mind first. It feels like one of the most visible and, frankly, terrifying for patients. What exactly are extrapyramidal effects, and why is it so critical that nurses understand the nuances of these motor disturbances beyond just a definition?
That's a great point, because EPS really are incredibly distressing and debilitating for patients, making them a top priority for nurses to understand. EPS are a group of adverse reactions involving motor disturbances.
Motor problems.
Right. Think of your basal ganglia as the brain's internal choreographer for movement, responsible for smooth, coordinated actions. When antipsychotics, especially typicals, block those critical D2 dopamine receptors there, it throws off the delicate balance with acetylcholine.
Dopamine-acetylcholine imbalance.
Exactly. And that leads to these involuntary and often painful motor symptoms. Understanding that why helps you connect the drug's action directly to the patient's experience, which is crucial for empathy and accurate assessment. There are four main types of EPS, and knowing them inside and out is crucial for your assessments as a nurse.
First, acute dystonia. What does that look like in a patient? How quickly can it develop, and how would a nurse recognize it?
Acute dystonia can develop rapidly, often within hours or days of starting medication or increasing a dose. And it is incredibly frightening for patients. Sometimes it's even mistaken for a seizure.
Really? Okay.
It involves that imbalance of dopamine and acetylcholine, causing muscles to involuntarily tense and the body to contort in unusual, often painful, postures. Classic examples include an oculogyric crisis, where the eyes roll back and become fixed in an upward gaze for minutes or hours, or torticollis, a severely twisted and painful neck, or retrocollis, where the head is pulled back.
That sounds awful.
It is. You might also see laryngeal dystonia, where the vocal cords seize, leading to difficulty breathing and a terrifying sense of choking. Young men are often more vulnerable to developing this particular type of EPS.
So what does a nurse do?
As a nurse, if you see this, your immediate action is to call the provider and anticipate an order for an anticholinergic antiparkinsonian agent like benztropine or diphenhydramine to quickly relieve the spasm.
Okay, quick action needed. Then there's akathisia. I've heard this one can be easily missed or, even worse, misinterpreted by healthcare providers, leading to potentially harmful interventions.
Exactly. Akathisia, also due to that dopamine and acetylcholine imbalance, is characterized by a profound and intense sense of restlessness. And I mean, profound.
Like they can't sit still.
It's more than that. Patients feel an overwhelming, almost agonizing internal drive to keep moving. They might pace relentlessly, shift their weight constantly, cross and uncross their legs in an endless loop.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly uncomfortable, almost torturous sensation for them, often described as an internal jitteriness rather than just external movement.
Internal jitteriness, okay.
The critical point for nurses, and this is where your assessment skills are paramount, is that this can be tragically misinterpreted by healthcare professionals as anxiety or even an increase in underlying psychotic symptoms like agitation.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine? They're suffering intensely from a drug side effect, and we, unknowingly, might increase their antipsychotic medication, which, paradoxically, only perpetuates and worsens the side effect, trapping them in a truly vicious cycle. It's a stark reminder of the importance of precise observation and careful differentiation between drug side effects and underlying symptoms. Beta blockers or benzodiazepines may be used to treat this.
And Parkinsonism. Yeah. Is it literally like Parkinson's disease or just similar symptoms? And who is most at risk?
In appearance, it is indeed strikingly identical to Parkinson's disease. It presents with the classic triad of symptoms. Tremors, often a resting tremor in the hands, a pill rolling tremor. Rigidity or stiffness in the limbs and trunk, often described as cogwheel rigidity, and bradykinesia, which is a generalized slowing of movement leading to a shuffling gait, masked facies, a lack of facial expression, and difficulty initiating movements.
Just like Parkinson's.
Exactly. It's caused by the blockade of D2 receptors in the basal ganglia, which disrupts the normal balance between dopamine and acetylcholine in those motor control areas. This type of EPS tends to occur more frequently in older patients because they often have a naturally declining dopamine system.
And the treatment.
Again, anticholinergic antiparkinsonian drugs are the typical treatment.
Finally, tardive dyskinesia. This one sounds like it could be permanent, which must be a huge, devastating concern for patients and families. What does it look like, and how can nurses detect it early?
This is indeed the late-appearing form of EPS, which is a major concern precisely because it can be persistent and, in some cases, irreversible,
right, even
after the offending drug is discontinued.
Irreversible. That's serious.
Very. Tardive dyskinesia is characterized by abnormal, involuntary, and often constant movements. It primarily involves the mouth, tongue, and jaw. Think repetitive lip smacking, sucking, puckering, or uncontrolled tongue protrusion, sometimes called the bonbon sign, where the tongue pushes into the cheek like it's holding a candy.
Bonbon sign. Okay.
You might also see athetoid, sort of worm-like movements of the tongue and chewing motions, other facial movements like grimacing and eye blinking, and even movements of the trunk and limbs, such as rocking hips or jerking fingers and toes, can also be present.
So it could affect the whole body.
It can. What's fascinating here and deeply concerning is its late onset, often appearing after months or years of treatment, and its potential for persistence. This makes proactive monitoring and early detection absolutely paramount for nurses to mitigate its impact.
How do you screen for it?
The Ames Assessment Abnormal Involuntary Movement Scale is a critical tool you'll use regularly, often every few months, to screen for this. Early detection might allow for a change in medication before it potentially becomes irreversible.
Got it. Ames Assessment. Beyond EPS, which are a major concern, what are some of the other common side effects nurses need to monitor in patients on antipsychotic medications? There's a wide range of body systems affected, it seems.
You're right. The impact is systemic, and it's essential to monitor comprehensively. Nurses need to monitor for several other common side effects that can significantly impact a patient's quality of life and safety.
Like what?
Orthostatic hypotension is frequent. This requires nurses to monitor blood pressure carefully, especially when a patient changes positions and, you know, dangle those legs before standing to prevent falls and dizziness.
Right, orthostatics.
Hyperprolactinemia can occur, meaning you check blood levels of prolactin. This can lead to issues like menstrual irregularities, galactorrhea, that's breast milk production, and sexual dysfunction.
Things patients might be hesitant to report.
Exactly. So asking is important. Sedation and weight gain are also very common. This requires monitoring the patient's level of consciousness, assessing for oversedation and regular weight checks, with an eye towards patient education and management strategies like diet and exercise to prevent metabolic syndrome.
The metabolic issues again.
Yes. There's also the risk of new onset diabetes, necessitating vigilant patient teaching about lifestyle and regular blood sugar checks like HbA1c. Cardiac arrhythmias, particularly QT prolongation, require EKG monitoring, especially with some of the first-gen drugs.
Okay.
And as we discussed with clozapine, a granulocytosis is a severe life-threatening risk with certain drugs, requiring regular WBC counts and temperature monitoring to catch early signs of infection.
Now, let's get into the truly critical, life-threatening complications that demand immediate nursing intervention. These are the situations where your quick thinking, your acute assessment skills, and rapid response can literally save a life. These are the emergencies you absolutely need to be prepared for.
Absolutely. These are not just side effects. They are medical emergencies that require immediate, decisive action. Early recognition and rapid response are paramount for nurses in these scenarios. Every second truly counts.
First, the anticholinergic crisis, or anticholinergic delirium. It has a classic, memorable set of symptoms that I've heard described with a vivid mnemonic. Can you break that down for us?
It does. And remembering this mnemonic is incredibly helpful for quick assessment in a high-stress situation. An anticholinergic crisis is a life-threatening condition. It results from an overdose or extreme sensitivity to drugs with potent anticholinergic properties, either from a single drug or a combination.
Okay, what's the mnemonic?
The classic signs and symptoms are often remembered by the mnemonic: hot as a hare, blind as a bat, mad as a hatter, dry as a bone.
Hot, blind, mad, dry. Got it.
It vividly describes a patient presenting with a profound fever, hot as a hare, dilated pupils causing blurred vision, often leading to photophobia, blind as a bat, acute, profound delirium, confusion, and hallucinations, mad as a hatter, and severely dry skin and mucous membranes, often with decreased sweating leading to hyperthermia, dry as a bone. They may also have urinary retention and absent bowel sounds.
That paints a clear picture.
The course of an anticholinergic crisis is generally self-limiting, usually resolving within about 3 days once the causative drug is discontinued. But the nurse's role is immediate and decisive.
What do you do?
You must report these symptoms to the physician without delay, and crucially, you must end stop the offending medication immediately. You'll need to prepare to administer physostigmin.
The antidote.
Yes, it's a cholinesterase inhibitor and acts as a direct antidote, reversing the anticholinergic effects. If it's an intentional overdose, you must also be ready for potential gastric lavage, administration of activated charcoal, or catharsis to remove the drug from the body. This is a situation where your acute assessment skills dictate swift, life-saving action. Your prompt recognition can literally turn the tide.
And the other major life-threatening complication, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, or NMS. This sounds incredibly severe, like a systemic collapse that can mimic other serious conditions. What are the hallmarks?
NMS is indeed a rare but extremely life-threatening adverse effect of antipsychotic medications, particularly the first-generation drugs, but it can occur with atypicals too. It's often difficult to diagnose because its symptoms can overlap with other severe conditions.
What are the key signs?
It's characterized by severe muscle rigidity, often described as lead pipe rigidity, where their muscles are so stiff they feel like solid pipes, making any movement incredibly difficult and painful.
Lead pipe rigidity.
Coupled with this, you'd note a profoundly elevated temperature, often spiking above 104 degrees, 40 degrees, sometimes even higher, that doesn't respond to typical fever reducers like acetaminophen.
High fever and rigidity.
Yes, those are core. This presentation is usually followed by a rapidly accelerating cascade of systemic symptoms. They might be acutely agitated, then profoundly confused and delirious. Their autonomic nervous system goes haywire.
Autonomic instability.
Exactly. Leading to labile blood pressure, fluctuating wildly, tachycardia, and profuse sweating. Their breathing could become labored, dyspnea, their heart rate racing, tachycardia, and without immediate intervention, this can quickly progress to respiratory failure and acute renal failure.
Renal failure, why?
Because the severe muscle breakdown releases toxins, myoglobin, into the bloodstream, which damages the kidneys. You'd see elevated CK levels, creatine kinase. It's a full body shutdown, a critical emergency that requires split-second recognition because it can deteriorate very, very quickly.
That sounds like a rapidly deteriorating patient, a true code blue situation. What's the nurse's role here? What do they need to do immediately, and how do they manage such a severe multi-system situation?
The nurse's role is absolutely critical, starting with early recognition of these rapidly escalating symptoms. This cannot be overstated. You are the first line of defense. If NMS is suspected, you must immediately withhold any antipsychotic medication the patient is receiving and notify the provider without delay.
Stop the drug, call the doc.
Immediately. Time is brain and time is life here. You should then prepare to administer specific medications: dopamine agonists like bromocriptine to counteract the dopamine blockade, and powerful muscle relaxants such as dantrolene or maybe benzodiazepines to manage the severe muscle rigidity and hyperthermia.
Okay, specific meds for NMS.
Yes. Your interventions extend to aggressive symptomatic support. Frequent vital sign monitoring is non-negotiable, along with aggressive fever treatment, cooling blankets, maybe antipyretics, although they often don't work well here, comprehensive laboratory testing to monitor organ function, CK, renal function, electrolytes.
Lots of monitoring.
And general supportive measures to promote patient safety and manage the cascade of systemic symptoms. This might include IV fluids, respiratory support, continuous cardiac monitoring. If we connect this to the bigger picture, recognizing NMS early and intervening rapidly can literally mean the difference between life and death for the patient. It's a testament to the profound impact of attentive and skilled nursing care.
Wow, what an incredibly comprehensive and truly crucial deep dive into antipsychotic medications. From understanding their different classifications and how they, subtly tweak brain chemistry, to the critical, potentially life-saving nursing considerations for monitoring side effects and complications, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground. This truly goes beyond memorization to real-world application.
Indeed. This journey really underscores the profound impact of these medications and, more importantly, the indispensable role of the vigilant, knowledgeable nurse in ensuring patient safety and promoting optimal outcomes. It's really about empowering you to be that essential link in the chain of care, transforming theoretical knowledge into life-saving practice.
So, what does this all mean for you as you move forward in your nursing studies and practice? This isn't just theory, it's really a blueprint for patient care, a set of principles and practices that you'll apply every single day you step onto a unit.
As you think about applying this knowledge, consider how early and accurate assessment of subtle changes in a patient on these medications isn't just a clinical skill you learn for a test, right?
Right.
It's often the very first line of defense against potentially life-threatening complications. It truly highlights the profound impact of attentive, critical nursing care and how every nurse is an essential, irreplaceable link in the chain of patient safety. So keep those critical thinking hats on, trust your instincts, and never stop observing your patient's well-being really depends on it.